Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. The Mexican national elections will take place on July the 1st. Leading in the polls is Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's categorized as either a reformist, a leftist, or both, depending on your point of view. In this week's episode, we'll discuss what's at stake for the region and for U.S.-Mexican relations. Joining us is Arturo Saracan. He's the former Mexican ambassador to the United States. And Andrew Seeley, director of the Migration Policy Institute. He's the author of the book Vanishing Frontiers. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray.
Every 6 years, as the first Sunday in July approaches, Mexico gears up for a national election. This one features one of the more familiar faces in Mexican politics. The third time may be the charm for Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Ambassador Arturo Saracan, it's been my experience in long years of covering Mexico and Mexican affairs that Americans have, let's say, an imperfect impression of your country. Give us, from your point of view, an update on the state of play currently inside Mexico. As the country gets ready to go to the polls, what kind of mood is it in?
I think it's more or less in the same foul mood as most democracies are in today. You've seen it in Europe. You've seen it certainly in this country, in the U.S. You've seen it in Brazil. You've seen it in Chile. Mexico is no exception. And there's a common thread, which is a general sense of malaise regarding politics as usual, traditional political parties, and traditional politicians, which in part explains why the front runner in Mexico today is the front runner. But there's an added, obviously, ingredient in Mexico, which is also present in other Latin American countries today, which is a society and public opinion that are absolutely fed up with what has been corruption beyond the pale. The Mexicans are going to vote on July 1st. Basically driven by their perceptions of these core issues: corruption, impunity, lack of accountability and transparency, and then the issue of public insecurity. Those are the salient drivers for how Mexicans are going to vote. And this is why a candidate who has now been running for three consecutive presidential elections on a platform, on an agenda of taking on corruption, of painting himself as a squeaky clean politician, and during 6 years in which most Mexicans felt that corruption went through the roof, this has become a very important factor in how Mexicans are going to vote. You know the saying, there are moments and countries where corruption has occurred under the table. There are moments where corruption has happened over the table. Many Mexicans believe that in the past 6 years, corruption in Mexico has included the table. So this is what has fed, I think, in many ways, this very compelling and, I think, decisive lead that López Obrador has amassed before Mexicans go to the polls on July the 1st.
I do want to talk further about corruption, both public and private. But the interesting news that's coming up from Mexico to American ears is that over 100 candidates for public office in Mexico have been killed during this election season. That's a shocking number.
It's a shocking number, and it's an issue that, sadly, both abroad and in Mexico itself, not too many people are paying attention to. And Ray, I think it speaks to an issue which first came to public salience and relevance back in 2006, when the then winner of the 2006 presidential election, Felipe Calderón, after the transition, Mexico has a horrendously long 5-month transition from July 1st, which is the election day, to December the 1st, which is the day that new governments get sworn in. During those 5 months, then president-elect Calderón realized that organized crime had seeped into the local, particularly local and state politics. And what you've just mentioned here is, I think, a very painful, dramatic example of how this continues to be a challenge. Many of these either candidates for local or state office, local politicians at the municipal level mainly, are being killed because we think either they have not wanted to be part of the agenda that organized crime seeks to push forward in some of these municipalities and localities. They're being killed because they are perceived to be close to rival criminal organizations, or simply because they've not accepted the terms that organized crime has laid in front of them, if they are to win, or if they were to win, local or state level office. So this is a very dramatic issue. It points to what I think is one of Mexico's Achilles heels, which is a weak rule of law and the endemic challenges that Mexican institutions face in confronting criminality and organized crime, whether it's transnational or it's local. And this is an issue that's not going to go away. It's going to be there. It's going to be one of the most important issues that the next Mexican president, regardless of who he is, will have to confront starting on December the 1st. And what, in my view, is worrisome is that if you look at the platforms and the campaign promises of all Mexican contenders for the presidency, there's precious little, Ray, as to how they are planning to take on the scourge of crime, whether it's, again, transnational or local, how they're going to rebuild a social contract in Mexico that has been broken, how they're going to create greater human security and greater social resilience and greater institutional bandwidth and strength to confront violence, corruption, and issues like the ones that you've mentioned, which are truly shocking.
You were a close advisor to President Calderón in the early period about security, about specifically some of these problems. The president then went on to take a very aggressive stance, to use the army domestically, to use security forces, deploy them on the streets of Mexican cities, to, in effect, go to war against these crime organizations. Mexico's murder rate zoomed, increased by 300%. Now, with 12 years perspective since that effort began, do you think it at least put a dent in the challenge that the country has? When you hear stories coming out of Monterrey, out of Tijuana, out of Juarez, places that had been murder capitals, and now they are relatively pacified, is that a source of some satisfaction or only a reminder in the midst of this campaign season of how much work remains to be done?
I think there's no doubt, Ray, that there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Some of it has to be done by Mexico and by Mexico alone. The reconstruction of institutional resilience and strength, my greatest concern, which is a social contract that has been broken, and a paradigm that does not work, because in my view, the problem lies with how Mexico, but also the United States and other countries, have been confronting transnational organized crime and illicit drugs for over three decades. It's a paradigm that I think is broken. You don't have to be a Nobel Economy Prize winner to figure out that as long as the demand for drugs is completely inelastic and the supply for drugs is completely elastic, the only thing that happens by putting pressure on the supply side is that you create incentives for new actors to come into the business of production and trafficking, which is where the greatest money is made in the chain of illicit drug production, trafficking, and consumption. You're creating incentives for more actors to come in, and when to that you add a strategy, which I think has been the wrong one, of thinking that if you decapitate the leadership of these drug organizations, the so-called kingpin strategy, where by going after the leaders, you sort of basically leave a headless chicken. This strategy has only created vacuums that are immediately filled by new and more aggressive and probably less professional individuals in terms of their ability to control their organizations, and it has spawned greater violence. When President Calderon came into office, it was clear that drug traffickers and drug organizations were the most prescient threat to the rule of law. And that's why he decided to confront and push back in ways that no previous government in Mexico had done in the past. The decision to use the armed forces was originally conceived as a stopgap measure. There's a good reason why in the United States you have something called the Posa Comitatus Act, which prevents the armed forces from being used in law enforcement. Armed forces aren't policemen. They don't do law enforcement. They don't do public security. And therefore, the decision at that moment to bring in the army to play this role in pushing back against extremely violent organized crime was probably the right one, but it had to be slowly substituted by the establishment and creation of a federal civilian police force. The problem is that Mexico was left sort of without either one. It was left with a policy that should have been a stopgap measure and that has, for all purposes, become more permanent, and it did not recreate or create the civilian police institutions that it needed to be able to then pull the army back into the barracks and then have civilian law enforcement institutions confront organized crime. Levels of deaths related to organized crime had started to level off by 2012, Ray. They started even going down in the first year of this current Mexican administration, but this administration took its foot off the gas pedal, and what you're seeing now is that last year and this year will have witnessed levels of homicides related to organized crime or to crime that have far gone beyond the height of what we saw in probably 2010 and 2011, which were the most violent years of the Calderon administration. And those records have been broken in the last 2 years, and the trends continue to grow.
The main party's candidates for president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known by the acronym AMLO, leads a consortium of parties known as Morena. José Antonio Meade is the candidate from the long-governing, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI. And Ricardo Anaya Cortés is from the PAN and the PRD, some strange bedfellows there. Are there major differences between their platforms? Are what the three men, the three leading candidates, are telling Mexicans about the state of the country and about what they plan to do about it really very different?
If we look at it from where they stand on a number of social policy issues, Ray, very little difference. They're very conservative on social values and social issues, even though AMLO is traditionally referred to in international media and the U.S. press as a leftist. Some of the positions that you would immediately, automatically regard as positions that would be part of a left or left-leaning agenda, those aren't there. What I find is a great paradox is that it is very likely that along with López Obrador under his coalition, he has aligned himself with a very conservative evangelical party in Mexico that is anti-abortion, anti-equality in marriage, etc., that one of the most conservative platforms will wind its way into the Mexican Congress because it is piggybacking on López Obrador's Morena platform. So if you look at it from that perspective, there's very little difference. The three main contenders are socially conservative. None of them have, for example, we were talking about the issue of criminality and violence and organized crime. None of them have, for example, weighed in on whether legalization of certain illicit substances is a way to confront and tackle the problems of insecurity in Mexico. Foreign policy, yes, López Obrador seems to have a more 70s view of what Mexico's foreign policy needs to look like. He would, I think, turn the clock back on how Mexico needs to punch above its weight in the international arena, particularly on issues of human rights and democracy. The other two candidates seem to be a bit more aligned to a more modern, cosmopolitan view of how Mexico needs to play in the world arena. In terms of social policies, yes, some differences. I think there's a more orthodox positioning by both Anaya of the PAN and PRD, this center-left, center-right coalition that he leads, certainly with Meade, who's been a finance minister both at the end of the Calderón administration and during the Peña Nieto administration. There are big questions raised to what does López Obrador really stand for a number of economic policy issues. On the one hand, he seems to suggest that he is not a anti-business candidate, but if you listen to some of the Morena backbenchers and some of the people in his campaign, when they talk about issues, for example, like the energy reform, which is a very significant achievement of the current administration, they would seem to suggest that their preference would be to annul, to revert the energy reform, despite the fact that López Obrador has said that he doesn't want to do that. But there's a bit of a back and forth on a number of positions on economic and social policy. So we don't know exactly which López Obrador is the one that we will see if he wins on July the 1st, which everything seems to suggest that he will, and what his team will look like by the time that he assumes office on December the 1st.
One thing that's been consistent during the time of the late campaign season in the United States, when Enrique Peña Nieto was already president of Mexico, through Trump's victory to the inauguration, to the first months of the administration, is that the current Mexican president has been shellacked for what was seen as an accommodationist stance toward the very aggressive new American president. Has there been a Trump effect in the Mexican election? Do the candidates talk about how they would treat the United States and how they would deal with President Trump differently from the current Mexican president?
Let me answer this way. No, Mexicans will not go to the polls come July the 1st and vote for whomever they vote for based on either Trump or the relationship with the United States. This is not the driver of the election. It's the issue of impunity, corruption, lack of transparency, accountability, and public insecurity. That's how Mexicans are going to choose who wins or who doesn't win the election come July 1st. Now, having said that, yes, obviously, because of the fact that President Trump has used Mexico as a political electoral piñata from the days of his primary campaign and now throughout his administration, yes, candidates have been talking about how they would engage President Trump. There is, because of what President Peña Nieto did during the campaign of inviting then-candidate Trump to go down to Mexico, a sense that this president has not been willing or able to confront Trump and to defend Mexico, using the words that most of the candidates are using. So there's a lot of bluster as to, I will make Trump respect Mexico. There was a bit of that in the second presidential debate of about a month and a half ago. But frankly, Ray, for a country that has a 3,000-kilometer contiguous land border with the United States, the U.S. has played a relatively small role in the elections. That doesn't mean that public opinion has not reacted to what has been coming from Washington, D.C. this past year and a half. You don't have to be Kissinger to figure out why, of all the countries around the world, it's Mexico where you've seen the steepest drop in favorable perceptions of the United States. In a year, favorable perceptions of the U.S. and Mexico went from 77% to 31%. It is the country where they've dropped the most in the world. That is a challenge because, again, regardless of who wins on July 1st, this public sentiment could significantly constrain the appetite, the bandwidth, the political maneuverability of a new Mexican administration in continue building the strategic forward-leaning relationship that we had been building with the United States for the past 20 plus years. And that could be a potentially challenging problem, particularly for many in the U.S. who have taken Mexico for granted these years.
I spent a lot of 2006 in Mexico, and I covered the López Obrador campaign some, followed him around the country, even spoke to him briefly after a campaign rally in Toluca. And he was tougher on the United States. He spoke in very aggressive terms about asserting Mexican sovereignty, about asserting Mexican pride and equality in the relationship. Has he changed? Has he tempered some of that rhetoric? Have the times in the country changed in such a way that that's not really the issue, so he doesn't really bring it up that much?
There's no doubt that he has softened his tone, softened his rhetoric, and changed his narrative regarding the relationship with the United States. First of all, I think that he's been very clear throughout his campaign in trying to underscore that he will not be poking his finger gratuitously in the eye of the United States, that he is not a Hugo Chavez. Remember, this was used pretty effectively to dent his campaign in 2006 by comparing him to Hugo Chavez. So I think that that both because of that and because of his concern that Washington does not see him as a knee-jerk anti-American candidate and potential president, he has been very careful. He's been bending backwards during this whole campaign to underscore that he will not gratuitously take on the United States and that he will seek to establish constructive, mutually respectful relationships with the United States. In part, this is also because I think as this relationship between Mexico and the United States has morphed over the past 20 years, more and more Mexicans have a more nuanced, a more sophisticated understanding of what's at stake in the U.S. in the U.S.-Mexico bilateral relationship. Many Mexicans have someone in their families, a friend, a cousin, a brother, a sister, who live in the United States, who send money back from the United States to Mexico. I think Mexicans who, for decades in the earlier parts of the 20th century, had, you know, this very hate-love relationship with the United States, as this relationship has morphed and changed as a result of NAFTA, as a result of the enhanced cooperation, collaboration in confronting organized crime, in this understanding that shared responsibility has to be the name of the game in the bilateral relationship, I think that Mexican public opinion in general has become much more savvier and much more nuanced in its engagement with the United States. And I think that in many ways, López Obrador is also reflecting part of this. He has underscored, as you've probably seen, Ray, that he supports the successful renegotiation of NAFTA, that he wants to see an upgraded and modernized NAFTA as a result of the decision by President Trump to force open a renegotiation of the agreement. So he understands the role that NAFTA plays in the economic well-being and prosperity of not only Mexico, but of North America. So yes, you see a man who has shifted his position, who has shifted his discourse from the first time he ran as president in 2006 to what he sounds like today when he talks about the relationship with the United States. Now, obviously, the proof will be in the pudding. He is not a man who knows the United States extremely well. He will have to surround himself with a good team of U.S. hands and U.S. experts. But certainly there has been a noticeable change in tone.
Are Mexicans feeling vulnerable in the age of Trump when a man who runs for president wins and knows as little about Mexico as Donald Trump appears to, takes such a powerful position as a smaller country, as a country that is economically less potent, as a country that in many ways, and as you just illustrated, depends on a healthy and also friendly United States. Is this a period now? And are we talking in the middle of 2018 about a country that's feeling vulnerable because of what's going on in the United States?
I think there's undoubtedly a sense of vulnerability, particularly for Mexican Americans and for those 5 million undocumented Mexicans who live in the shadows in the United States and who are sending remittances to Mexico and their families. I think there is a greater sense of vulnerability. If you look at public opinion at large in Mexico, yes, but I think they've started to also read into the bluster and the bullying of this U.S. president. And there's also a sense that, yes, Mexico doesn't have nuclear weapons like North Korea, but Mexico is not toothless. There are many issues that Mexico brings to the table that also enhance the well-being, the security, and the prosperity of the United States, whether it's how Mexico and the United States have been working together quietly since 9/11 to ensure that potential terrorists don't threaten the United States by taking advantage of a 3,000-kilometer border with the United States, whether it's what Mexico to important criticism in Mexico and in Central America has been doing to deter Central American transmigration through Mexico to the United States. All these ag states, which, by the way, voted Trump in the Electoral College in the United States, that have Mexico as the number one trading partner and who are on the receiving end, Ray, of the reprisals that Mexico has slapped on the United States in response to the tariffs that the Trump administration put on Canada and Mexico on steel and aluminum. There's a clear sense that these are two societies that will fail or will succeed together. I think that Mexico, despite some of the challenges and the vulnerabilities that some perceive and feel in regards to this current administration, also know what Mexico brings to the table in what is a clear two-way street of mutual prosperity and mutual security with the United States. And so you're also seeing that at play today in Mexico.
That's Ambassador Arturo Sarukhan. For 6 years, he was the Mexican ambassador to the United States, Mexico's voice in Washington. Currently, he's a visiting professor at the Annenberg School of Public Diplomacy at the University of Southern California and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He joined me from Washington. Good to talk to you, Ambassador.
It's great to talk to you, Ray.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Arturo Sarukhan. He's the former Mexican ambassador to the United States, and Andrew Seeley, director of the Migration Policy Institute. He's the author of the book Vanishing Frontiers. The program is moderated by Ray Suarez. And now back to Ray.
Joining me now is Andrew Seeley, president of the Migration Policy Institute, founder of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He's the author of Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together. The New Economist magazine has AMLO on the cover in its North American and Latin American editions, calling him Mexico's Trump. Is that fair?
You know, there are some things that are true about that and other things that probably are less so. What certainly is true is, you know, to the extent Trump took over a political party in the United States and made it his, came as an insurgent candidate, AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, created his own political party. He left the left-of-center party that he had belonged to and that he'd led for a long time and created his own movement and is likely to win and maybe even majority in Congress with this movement that he's created out of nothing. Which means, you know, it's a strong personality-driven campaign, and ultimate, you know, he becomes the ultimate arbiter, as Trump does, of politics, at least of what happens at a national level. And so I think those comparisons are valid. But on the other hand, López Obrador is coming out of the left, and he, you know, he's operating in a slightly different political environment, and I suspect that in some ways they'll end up, what they do will end up looking very different on the ground, even if some of their personality traits may be similar and some of their political trajectory may be similar.
Enrique Peña Nieto, the president of Mexico, was really slapped around hard by his own electorate and by the political class in Mexico for being, in the view of many, too accommodating toward the new American president. is part of AMLO's appeal the combative tone? Will he be an effective leader in standing up to the American president in a way that people found Peña Nieto wanting in that department?
I think so. I mean, I don't think it's the main thing that people are looking at in this election. I mean, Mexicans are really looking at the fact that AMLO represents the one political movement that hasn't governed Mexico. You know, they want to change with the past, and he's the only one that is sort of the visible break with the past. And he's a personally austere candidate, personally austere person. And so at a time where, you know, Peña Nieto administration has projected, whether it's you know, true to the extent people believe it or not, but has been seen to be very corrupt administration, and at least in public perception. And so he's a man who is not moved by wealth, and I think projects that effectively to people. So those are the things that have moved the campaign, you know, and they see him as, you know, cleaning up corruption, whether he'll do it or not. They a lot of Mexicans trust him as the person to do that. But I think there is an element in which people also see him standing up to Trump, seeing him as a strong personality. All of the candidates have taken strong positions against Donald Trump, but he probably is the one who has the best claim to being able to say that he will be tough, and that he is less sympathetic overall towards Mexico's long-term engagement with the United States. He's not against it, but he's never been as much of a fan of it as the other two political parties that are running.
It's always a risk to look ahead when an election hasn't happened yet. We're talking just a cluster of days before Mexicans go to the polls, but Andrés Manuel López Obrador's lead is pretty large. So let's move on the assumption that he is likely to be the next president of Mexico. He lost by a whisker in 06. He lost by a lot in 12. But back in 06, when he lost, he created a shadow cabinet, occupied the center of Mexico City, the country's largest square, the symbolic heart of the capital. He used language that might have been more at home in the French Revolution. He launched political stunts for months as the Calderón administration gradually took control of the country. But it seems like there's very little residue left in 18 for some of that unconventional political behavior in 06, that the memories of that have been washed away. Is 12 years long enough for us not to remember him as perhaps having a rightful grievance over the vote count, but then acting like something of a wild card?
I think opinions divided on that. I mean, people who don't like him, people who are determined not to vote for him, remember that. And they think that his change is only skin deep, that it is, yes, he learned that wasn't popular and that wouldn't get him elected, but it's merely tactical to be seen as a moderate and as a much more pragmatic voice. And I think for others who are supporting him, they think it's a real learning curve, that over the last 12 years, he really did learn to be more of a statesman. He was always a charismatic politician, but he learned to be more of a statesman. He moved to the center. He learned that if he was going to govern Mexico, he had to be more inclusive and actually have some channels to the business community and to other political parties and to groups he didn't necessarily have a natural relationship with. But I think opinion's divided. I mean, if he wins, you know, he will have won the argument on this, at least gotten most Mexicans to believe, or a plurality of Mexicans to believe, that it's a new Andrés Manuel López Obrador, one who's ready to govern Mexico. But there will be a few people out there still doubting this and wondering if this was just a tactical move to the center.
In your new book, Vanishing Frontiers, you take a very strong position that seems to be pushing back against the current winds blowing through the bilateral relationship between Mexico and the United States. I mean, whether it's the wall, the threatened tearing up of NAFTA, factory-by-factory involvement of the President of the United States in individual country manufacturing decisions and trade matters, Trump is pushing back against your subtitle, the forces driving Mexico and the United States together. Away from the headlines, away from the high-level back and forth, are there things evolving far from the public's attention that are every bit as much a part of the U.S.-Mexico relationship?
I think there are. And look, there's no way to hide that this is a tough time in the U.S.-Mexico relationship at a political level. And it may get much worse. I mean, it may get better, but it could easily get worse. But the things that are going on that give me hope that we're actually continuing to get closer, despite what the politicians do and despite what happens in all these political decisions that have to be made, is, you know, watching border cities engage with each other in new ways, San Diego and Tijuana that share an airport, for example, or and for just pragmatic reasons. Looking at the way the film industries, Hollywood and the Mexican film industry, interact with four of the last five Oscar-winning directors are Mexican. You know, it tells you that there's a larger story going on in integration in the film industry. The way that firms interact and the way workers interact. I mean, it's hard to get into a car in the United States today that wasn't built by workers in Mexico, Canada, and the United States. The auto industry is completely integrated across the three countries. That the aerospace industry is headed that way. The nail industry. I mean, a lot of things in our manufacturing platform aren't really. We talk about American manufacturing, but it's really North American manufacturing. We have a platform that's deeply integrated across the three countries, and we could go on sports. I mean, we just did this joint World Cup bid among the three countries of North America that won last week, and you know, or 2 weeks ago, and it's an impressive story of people coming together outside of politics. And so what gives me hope that we're moving forward is when you begin to look at all these things happening, we go into innovation, technology innovation, there's a lot of things going on. There's just this larger story of people getting to know each other, doing things together for very pragmatic reasons across the border. And I think that's going to outlive whatever political noise we see in the next few years.
Are we at a point where we risk messing up the forces that you just described, the integration that was occasioned by NAFTA, occasioned by the global supply chains and the efficiencies that were achieved by moving certain things to the United States, certain things to Canada, certain things to Mexico? Is there a risk of being too cavalier about this for domestic political reasons, for almost jingoistic reasons?
I think there's a real risk, particularly with NAFTA. I mean, if we tear up NAFTA, which could happen, I don't think it's going to happen, but it really could happen. I do think there we would begin to take apart some of the underpinnings of the economy that have tied the three countries together. Wouldn't happen overnight, but it is something that would start to make it less advantageous to produce goods across the three countries. And unfortunately, I don't think that manufacturing would come back to the United States. It would go elsewhere in the world. So cars right now, even foreign car companies make their cars in North America. There are very few imports in the United States. But over time, if you don't have the North American platform, you'll see some of these companies move to other parts of the world. Not immediately, but over 10, 15, 20 years. So I think that's a real danger. I think there's a real danger in the statements we've heard from the United States, from political leaders in the United States, and some of the policies on immigration, talk about the wall, building some antibodies in Mexico. I mean, I think there's a growing reaction in Mexico against greater integration with the United States. I don't think it's yet very deep. I think right now it's mostly directed, you know, people don't like President Trump in Mexico. But that doesn't mean they don't like the United States, you know, and people will say things, you know, about other political leaders that they like a lot, Republicans and Democrats. So the Mexicans can distinguish between the president and the country. But I think the more this goes on, it could begin to generate a reaction in Mexico against greater integration with the U.S. And I think it could generate a reaction in segments of the United States against Mexico. I mean, we've already seen that, and that could grow beyond being a minority of Americans to be a much larger group. And I think that could be poisonous in the future. Again, I don't think that's where we're headed. I think the story is more optimistic, and I think the likelihood is that we're going to continue to get closer despite the political noise on both sides. But I think there is a danger there. I mean, you could see some of these things actually creating some reverse momentum.
I'm very interested in the way you put it right there, because when I look at Mexico and the United States, I think of us as intimate strangers. There are a million Americans living in Mexico, and as boomers age, the second million will come even faster. Yet Americans hold such wild views of the place, driven in part by news coverage, driven largely by the cartel war, rather than the lived daily experience of tens of millions of Mexicans. And yet at the same time, there are millions of Mexicans with very intimate understanding of the U.S. and the real effects for good and ill of the relationship. And it's a very interesting thing that it persists decade after decade. Many Mexicans know America very well. Not many Americans know Mexico very well, but I think that may be changing.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think historically, Mexicans have known the U.S. because they depended on it. I mean, it's 80% of Mexico's exports come to the United States, so the economy is heavily dependent. But also, because of the long period, almost two decades, when Mexicans were emigrating to the United States, you had people developing these personal ties. You know, almost everyone knows, whatever social class in Mexico, will have someone who lives in the United States. They'll know, you know, a close relative, a friend. They have a personal reference to the U.S. They know things about American life because of a relative or a friend. And so it's a really, a much more intimate relationship. I think that's now happening on the other side as well. I mean, it's going to be slower. The U.S. is a bigger country. Not everyone has as much contact with Mexico. But increasingly, Americans do have contact with Mexicans who have immigrated to the United States. As you say, a million Americans living in Mexico also have relatives back on the U.S. side and close friends who've gotten to know Mexico through them. And it may be more. The U.S. Embassy actually calculates that there could be as many as 1.5 million, 1.8 million Americans in Mexico. That's higher than figures I've seen, but at least people who live there part of the time. This is actually, it's a large number of people. It's more people than Americans than live in all of Europe. So it's a very large number of Americans. And then if you take border communities, you know, I used to think of San Diego and Tijuana as being the border where I lived for many years. But increasingly, Los Angeles is the border. And, you know, Tucson is the border, but Phoenix is kind of a border city as well. And El Paso is a border city in Texas, but San Antonio has really become a border city, and Dallas has become a border city. And the border is moving out in many ways. You know, people actually interact in real time in much more active ways across the border. And then all the economic ties and the innovation ties. I spent a lot of time actually hanging out with tech innovators at one point in Guadalajara and Silicon Valley, and how many ties there are there that have nothing to do with government, where they're simply trying to invent creative technology together and find investors for it. And how much just goes back and forth on this California-Mexico axis, you know, all around innovation. A lot of these things are really exciting are happening outside of government, and they're giving people these direct, palpable ties to the other side of the border. And Mexicans got it first, but we're getting it in heavy spades right now in the United States as well. And that makes me think the newer generations are growing up with a different relationship with Mexico than what older generations did. It's much more present in their lives.
At the turn of the century, there were forces on both sides of the border working hard to make the border more of a state of mind, more of a daily irrelevance than a hard and fast frontier line. Then terrorism and politics intervened, and it became harder to cross, more expensive to cross, more complicated to cross. Businesses that were built on both sides of the border oriented toward cross-border traffic. Many of them failed because the border became a more impermeable reality. In your book, you seem to describe an America and a Mexico that are picking up where, well, we might call it 9/10 left off, the day before 9/11. The time when there was a lot of optimism about the Mexican-American relationship, when Vicente Fox was the first foreign head of state to visit the new president, George W. Bush. Are we picking up where we left off?
You know, I think we are, and I think not only are we picking up where we left off, but, you know, technology has advanced in such a way that we're doing new and different things that make the border, you know, more of a seam and less of a barrier. I mean, that actually, or do both at the same time. I mean, the new thinking about the border has been, you know, how do you make it both safe and efficient? And beginning to think that those things come together. So, you know, things like segmenting out traffic, people who cross frequently, people who, trucks that cross frequently, you know, who are willing to give their financial information to undergo background checks so that we know that they are, you know, legitimate crossers, separating those out from other flows. And so you actually begin to segment flows and you make some of those flows move much quicker. They need less inspection. That actually makes things move a lot faster, both in terms of goods, but also in terms of people across the border. Beginning to put Mexican and U.S. inspectors together. I mean, I think this would surprise most people, but even now where things are so tense politically, you know, the new trend in border crossings is to have Mexican and U.S. inspectors standing next to each other. instead of you go through and you check out of one country, especially if you're coming with a truck full of goods, you know, with the Mexicans or the U.S., and then you get to the other inspector on the other side of the border, increasingly we're putting them next to each other. And the reason for that is, one, is it's more efficient. You just do one simple process to get across. But two is they actually can share intelligence in real time. And we've gotten to a point where there's a level of trust in sharing information back and forth. And so increasingly, and this has happened even when, you know, while we're, you know, spitting at each other across the border in political terms, you know, on the ground level, you know, the agencies that work with each other day to day have just decided that there's enough trust going on that they can do these kind of things. And so the new border crossings, that's the way it's done. Well, you know, you get people actually standing next to each other. And we even have some pre-inspection points where we have U.S. and Mexican inspectors together in each other's countries. We have this in Phoenix. We have it in Laredo, Texas. And we have it on the other side in two different places in Mexico as well. And that would have been unthinkable a few years ago. It's the kind of stuff we did with Canada. We've done this with Canada for a long time. But we reached that level of trust and that level of technology that we could do it with Mexico as well.
So how come our politics are being carried on in a way that almost operates as if those things that you describe aren't happening? That the border is a wild and dangerous place, that the border is a place that is out of control and was left, a door left ajar by the previous administration. In a world where there are thousands of Americans and thousands of Mexicans who know that some of these descriptions don't capture reality, it doesn't seem to penetrate our politics, the world that you're describing.
There's just enough truth in it, even though it's not overall true, that you can make a case out of it. And so I think the first thing to say is, I mean, as you said earlier, Mexico still is an unequal country. It still does have a major problem with rule of law and with violence. You know, these are things that are in the American mind about Mexico. And it doesn't take a lot with one sector, you know, some sectors of the American public to raise up those things above other things that are going on. And there still are people crossing the border. We're at the lowest number of people last year. There were the lowest number of people crossing the border legally since 1971. I mean, that's 46 years. There is no crisis at the border. We could do better. We could actually, you know, we do need to control our borders. There's no question. You know, over time, we could get much closer to it. But there is enough of a truth that people are still crossing. That if you want to blow up and look at the parts that aren't working and magnify them, you can make a case out of it, and some people will believe you. It's you're not making it up out of whole cloth. You may be exaggerating it, but you're not making it up entirely out of whole cloth. You know, that said, I think sometimes when we're talking about the border or we're talking about Mexico, we're talking about ourselves in the United States. And I tell this to friends and colleagues in Mexico sometimes that, you know, not everything we say about you is really about you. Some of it is, but some of it we're talking to ourselves about issues that we're debating, and you've become a proxy, you know, and I'm sorry for that, but in some ways you've become a proxy for our own internal conversations about how we want to relate to the world, about demographic change in the United States and immigration, about our fears of terrorism coming across borders, though no terrorists have come across the U.S.-Mexico borders. But in many ways, the wall that President Trump proposed during the campaign is a great metaphor, but it's not a great metaphor for dealing with Mexico, because we haven't had terrorist attacks from Mexico. Immigration, particularly illegal immigration, is down. Trade is actually mutually beneficial in this relationship. But it is a good metaphor for fears about a world that is dangerous in many ways and that we're trying to come to terms with.
Does estrangement with Mexico, hostility from Washington, create an opening for China in much the way that ignoring Latin America for a long time has created an opening there for China?
I think it does. I mean, the Chinese have been very cautious with Mexico. I think their read has been that they don't want to interfere in a country next door to the United States or be seen as interfering in a way that would really raise hackles in Washington. And so there's a great relationship between Mexico City and Beijing. And, you know, there have been mutual visits and there's a lot going on in rhetorical terms, but there isn't really as much going on as there is with the rest of Latin America. The Chinese government has been very cautious about investment in Mexico and being seen as having too big a role. That could change over time. I mean, particularly if, you know, a Chinese government that feels more confident more estranged itself from the United States and a Mexican government that feels more estranged from the U.S. government. I mean, it certainly is one of the paths down the road. I'm not sure what happened immediately, but you could see a scenario in which it's a good opportunity for China to be seen as becoming incredibly active very close to the U.S. border. And again, Mexicans have been very cautious too, as much as they want to open another relationship with China and they see, you know, they want to recognize China's rising influence, they've been careful not to send signals to Washington that they are doing anything that would upset U.S. policymakers on this. But that could certainly change over time. I mean, I think that is one of the possible scenarios down the road.
I was in Peru during the healing period in the U.S. economy. And things were going great guns in Peru, and several economists told me, look, you know, we saw the way our economy was oriented so heavily toward the United States, exports toward the United States, and we thought that that wasn't good for us, so we started to look elsewhere, and sure enough, in the port near Lima, they couldn't fill up the freighters fast enough with raw materials heading to China. China hasn't been sitting still waiting for the Western Hemisphere's political relationships to sort themselves out.
No, I think that's true. And yet, much of the South American relationship with China and Peru, Chile, Brazil, I mean, have incredible trading relationships now with China is around commodities. Yeah, and Mexico is less of a commodity economy than the South American economies are. I mean, Mexico really is a manufacturing economy. And it's not clear that Mexico has the ability to turn to China as, you know, to become a new export market in the same way that the South American countries have. They could probably open a few new markets. I mean, I think that could happen. But in many ways, the Chinese and Mexican economies are complementary in that way. And it may not be that easy to actually turn to China as the alternative. But there are a lot of other markets out there. I mean, you could probably open a little bit in the Chinese market, but looking at Europe actually, and Mexico is often Mexicans have often wanted to diversify away from the United States and the dependence on exporting to the United States. It's never happened in part because it really hasn't been needed, because the integration is so seamless between Mexico and the United States and with Canada as well. You know, it's just the natural path. If it becomes harder, if NAFTA falls apart, if we have tariffs in place, then I think we will see Mexico looking elsewhere. I think, you know, that will, you know, necessity will drive that. And I think that could be a changed world for us.
One of the hardest things for Americans to understand is the gruesome, gothic, hard to describe level of bloodshed and violence that happens in parallel, side by side to the enjoyment of Mexico in Puerto Vallarta, in Querétaro, in Tulum, in many places in the country where Americans go, have a wonderful time, practice their Spanish, eat interesting food, come home and think, wow, I didn't see roadblocks. I didn't see domestically deployed army forces. I didn't see decapitated heads on a road. Yet both those things are true at the same time. And I think it's hard for Americans to put it into context, to understand where Mexico's really at.
I think it's hard for Mexicans to understand that too. I mean, the reality is that Mexico has progressed in some ways so fast in a short period of time, much more of a modern economy. It's become, you know, it's developed world-class institutions. Many of the cities are wonderful places to live. And yet at the same time, there is intense poverty in Mexico. When you get into some other institutions, particularly those around rule of law, police and courts and prosecutors and defenders, it's very weak, right? And often corrupted. There's a lot of corruption in politics that lives on. And so Mexico has both become a very modern, contemporary, complex, rich country in many ways, culturally rich, fascinating, great place to visit, great place to live. I mean, there's a reason why so many Americans have moved to Mexico. You can have a great quality of life living there. And yet at the same time, many Mexicans live in situations either of extreme poverty or extreme violence or both. And it really is contradictory and it really is happening at the same time. And there are places where it happens out of view. The violence particularly happens out of view. I tell in the book the story of Tijuana, where I lived in the 1990s, which has become one of Mexico's most culturally rich, fascinating middle-class cities. But it also is a very high violence rate, and you don't see the violence that much anymore in Tijuana, but there is violence going on around the margins everywhere. And you can the more you know the city, the more you can feel it, even if you don't actually see it happening. And there are other parts of Mexico, if you go to the state of Guerrero, for example, where violence is very much in the open, right? And people live with it day to day. And there are parts of Guerrero that no tourists go to, but also many Mexicans, if they don't have to go there, don't go there. And many Mexicans who live there are trying to get out. And those realities live side by side. And then there are parts of Mexico that have very little violence. I mean, there are many, many places in Mexico where violence is not part of the reality. And you know, all these Mexicos live next to each other at the same time, and they're all part of today's Mexico.
So, Andrew Seely, what's an election day in Mexico like? What should Americans know about the way Mexicans vote and whether or not it's a straight-up, fair, and in this era of post-pre-domination, that party that dominated Mexican politics for 70 years, is it really a wide-open contest where people from different parties have a legitimate shot at winning office at all levels?
One of the things I really enjoy about elections in Mexico is it really is a civic day. And this is partially because things were so bad for so long. I mean, Mexico was a one-party system. Elections got stolen. You know, there's huge distrust around politicians and elections. And so they turned over the election machinery to an independent organization that's appointed by the Congress, but it's fairly independent. And on election day, you have average citizens out there running the election booths and counting the votes. And it's a way in public, right? And it has to be done in a way that is transparent and seen by all, so there's trust in the election. And so lots of Mexicans get involved in the electoral process in really tangible ways beyond voting, you know, sitting at election booths, being monitors for the different political parties. I mean, it really is a civic festival, actually. It's a fascinating thing to watch. But I think the thing we should be watching is, you know, first of all, who wins? And it would be surprising if López Obrador doesn't win, but elections can surprise us, as we know in this country as well. I mean, it's not done till it's done. So see the margin of victory, see who wins in the end, and then see who wins Congress. Because if López Obrador wins and then wins a majority in Congress, which is something Mexico hasn't seen in 20 years, it's the end of divided government in Mexico. And maybe it will look, you know, it's the turn to the left and he's the candidate of change and the new candidate. But some people are going to say it looks a lot like Mexico did before 20 years ago, one single party that controls everything. And then I think it's worth looking, does that happen? You know, is he a new kind of politician who believes in pluralism, who's got a majority in Congress but governs as a true Democrat? Or is he trying to build the old system of single party rule? And I don't think we know the answer to that yet.
Well, it bears watching. And Mexico, the relationship with Mexico is one of the most important bilateral relationships that the United States has in the world. You'd never know that. Looking at the politics of recent years. Andrew Seely, thanks a lot for joining us.
Ray, it was great to be with you. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Arturo Saracan, he's the former Mexican ambassador to the United States, and Andrew Seely, director of the Migration Policy Institute and author of the book Vanishing Frontiers. The program was moderated by my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. Our engineer is Marcy Krivenin of the Aspen Institute. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.